Well, lots of things are going to change on Monday, John, and one of them that may happen before then, may happen on Monday, is this potential ceasefire with Israel and Gaza.
Yep, and joining us now is CBS News military analyst Colonel Jeff McCausland, a frequent contributor here on the program and somebody we really rely on matters like this. Colonel McCausland, welcome, and it looks like in Doha, the two sides have reached an agreement, at least for the first phase of getting the hostages released.
Yeah, it does, John. It looks like we're at that point. We're still waiting final confirmation agreement by the Israeli cabinet, though I point out that the security cabinet has approved the agreement. There was some concern as several senior members of Mr. Netanyahu's cabinet, some very conservative members, actually were opposed to the ceasefire and had threatened to, frankly, bring down the government, potentially, if in fact it was signed. They seem to have been ameliorated, so we hopefully will go forward. May even see the initial hostages being released as early as Sunday.
Any idea the numbers? It looks like this first wave, they're talking about 33 of the Israeli hostages, focusing on women, the elderly, and the injured. We don't really know, or do we, how many actual hostages are still living in Gaza?
We do not. And the total number of hostages or people that are unaccounted for is about 94, 95. It's widely believed, sadly, that about a third of those are deceased. But the absolute numbers or even the identification, a full accounting of the identification of all those being held, has never been provided by Hamas. On the other side, of course, there will be up to a total, if all this comes together, of maybe as many as 3,000 Palestinians released in the first phase. For the 33 Israeli hostages held by Hamas, there will be probably around 1,000 Palestinians released from jails in Israel. And by the second phase, if that's accomplished, probably roughly 2,000 more Palestinians. Many of them, however, were arrested even before this war began and were serving, in some cases, life sentences, or were detained on the West Bank and were not directly involved in the hostilities in the Gaza Strip.
So what's the assessment on how damaged Hamas and, for that matter, Hezbollah to the north have become in the process over this last year plus of hostilities?
Well, the military capabilities of Hamas have been dramatically reduced, if almost eliminated. They still have, some people think, somewhere around a battalion or so of fighters left in the Gaza Strip, and they still are able to occasionally fire the odd rocket or mortar round in the direction of Israel. When it comes to the second part, though, is toward destroying Hamas, which had been an Israeli goal, it's probably impossible to destroy Hamas ideologically. And frankly, one of the things I'm concerned about is based on the destruction in the Gaza Strip, 45,000 dead, 100,000 or more injured, and a large percentage of those people were not members of Hamas, that you may have set the seeds for others to join another group later, whether that's Islamic Jihad or some shadow of Hamas in future. As far as Hezbollah goes, we've seen this dramatic taking out of a lot of the Hezbollah leadership when these pagers all exploded, and I think Hezbollah never recovered from that during the fighting with Israel. We have a temporary ceasefire in place, but the Israelis have done a pretty extensive job in destroying the military capabilities of Hezbollah, which were far superior to Hamas. But what that really means in the longer term is that Iran now is much more vulnerable. Its two primary proxies in the region, Hamas, Hezbollah, have lost their military capabilities, cannot really serve as a deterrent or a threat to Israel if, in fact, Israel sought to attack Iran directly. And furthermore, in the aftermath of two missile exchanges between Israel and Iran directly, the Israelis have been able to destroy a substantial portion of Iranian air defense, some factories they use to produce propellants for their missiles. So in many ways, Iran is about as vulnerable as they've been in the last decade. And that'll be part and parcel of how this all evolves over the weeks and months as we hopefully move in the direction of longer-term stability and a reduced level of violence.
Yeah, it's really the whole geopolitics of the region has fundamentally changed over the course of these many months. Saudi Arabia, I find very interesting in this whole equation. They were moving towards normalizing relations with Israel. Has that relationship been impacted by this, or is it too early to say?
Well, I think it has. I mean, I think it put on hold that movement towards normalization of relations. and sort of the price to be paid, I think, by the Israelis, if in fact those normalizations should move ahead, which would be a game changer, which would further isolate the Iranians, and I think be of enormous benefit from a security standpoint and from an economic standpoint for both countries and for the region, is the Palestinians, because the Saudis will insist, I'm sure, on some effort to either provide more self-governance to the Palestinians or some acknowledgments of the Palestinians or greater aid to Gaza. There'll be some part of that that the Saudis will insist on if normalization is in fact going to occur. But we've also skipped over, perhaps to me, one of the most important things that's happened, which was not necessarily totally directly related to the war in Gaza and with Hezbollah, and that is the collapse of the Assad government in Syria, which really, when you add all that up, it seems to me what's happened in the Middle East over the last 15 months is roughly equivalent metaphorically to the end of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact in terms of the dramatic change geopolitically.
This agreement's coming out, potentially on the day that there'll be a transition in leadership here in the United States, the Biden administration playing the role for the last year plus of trying to negotiate some type of peace. When we see the transition of power in the United States, do we anticipate that this agreement will be accepted by the Trump administration and that they'll continue through with it?
Yeah, I think we do. And I think actually one of the things we've seen over the last couple of weeks as this moves forward is probably the best of our democracy in terms of a transition. I mean, the transition that we kind of take as routine or celebratory is an amazing phenomenon, that one government's going to step away and very peacefully hand over the reins to another new government is pretty extraordinary if you look around the world. And as we moved into the last few days and weeks of this negotiation, we saw the Biden team, headed up by Mr. Biden's Middle Eastern negotiator, Brett McGurk, working very closely with the Trump team, headed up by a guy named Witkoff, in moving this forward. And Mr. Biden had outlined an agreement back in May, which really is the essence of this agreement today. But I think the Trump administration being involved was very, very important to bringing it to close. Mr. Trump, of course, had somewhat bombastically said that, you know, there's all hell going to pay if it wasn't concluded by the time he was inaugurated. While some interpret that as a message to Hamas, I took it more as a message, frankly, to the Iranians and to the Israelis. Iran, don't mess with this right now. You don't want to interfere with this right now. You want this agreement to come in place and a ceasefire to occur. And to those on the very conservative and somewhat extreme side of the Israeli government, you too do not want to get in the way of this. We need an agreement. And if you want the Trump administration to be supportive of you in future, as Trump was during his first term when he acknowledged the Golan Heights as part of Israel, when he moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, for example, then we need peace. We need this agreement to come into place.
Colonel Jeff McCausland is our guest, CBS News military analyst. And, you know, the future is murky. But I'm going to ask you to peer into your crystal ball. The Netanyahu government has been fragile, shall we say. It's built on a coalition. It's not always on the same page. There's a lot of discontent in Israel, has been, with Benjamin Netanyahu. Do you expect his government to stand for the course of the next several months, or is it teetering? And then secondly, what does a future Gaza look like?
Wow. How much time we got?
Take all you need.
Yogi Berra once said, it's hard to predict anything, especially the future. I think to some degree, the Netanyahu government is going to be called to account. I mean, if you go back to 1973 in the Yom Kippur War, the government was surprised by the attack by the Egyptians and by the Syrians. And there was an accounting of that a few months later, and as a result, that government was voted out of office and never returned to power. I think once we get beyond this war and get into a ceasefire, there are many in Israel that are going to insist on some kind of an accounting of what happened. How were we so strategically surprised back in October of 2023? And I think the Netanyahu government will suffer very poorly in that particular analysis, which could threaten, as you suggest, him politically, since he heads up a pretty narrow margin of in his cabinet and has to depend on several parties. as far as the future of Gaza, well, we got to get to phase three, which to me is the most important part. Phase one, release of 33 hostages, then negotiations for phase two for the release of the rest of the hostages and a pullout of the IDF. That's a very tough set of negotiations. If we can get through that, then we got to get to the third phase, which is the most important, and that's negotiations on the creation of a governing authority for Gaza and reconstruction. What might that governing authority look like? Well, back to those extreme members of Mr. Netanyahu's cabinet, they would tell you that the result should be we should force all 2.2 million Palestinians out of the Gaza Strip. They've never said where they're going to go, but force them out of the Gaza Strip and fill the Gaza Strip full of very peaceful Israeli settlers, and that'll settle Gaza Strip forever. I don't think that's going to happen, but there are those who advocate that particular position. Then you have to see who's brought in to provide that governance. Many people, myself I think included, have been critical of the fact that Mr. Netanyahu has not tried to find a partner that he could begin talking to as a future, at least part of the political end state for the Gaza Strip. Most people would point at the Palestinian Authority, which is fairly weak, but what's your alternative? Them and some perhaps international presence, maybe a peacekeeping force presence that can bring basic services, medical, sanitation, water, et cetera, into the Gaza Strip. Not only that, but of course the monumental task of overseeing a reconstruction for an area that suffered 45,000 plus killed, 100,000 injured, 70% of all structures destroyed or damaged, and the entire population of at least 80% of the population of 2.2 million being displaced at least once, if not multiple times, as this war was conducted.
Good stuff. He is Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS News military analyst, and kind enough to always join us on Hancock and Kelly. Colonel, have a good weekend, brother.